nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
It's my great pleasure to introduce to you today Dr. Mark Lundstrom. He's a distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering here at Purdue University. He obtained both his bachelor's and master's degree at the University of Minnesota and his PhD here at Purdue. His research interests include semiconductor device physics, computational electronics, and nanotransistors. In fact, the thing that you're going to just be listening to. There's a slight change in the title. The title of presentation is Electronics, Microelectronics, and Nanoelectronics.
Okay, thank you, Jacques. It's a very great pleasure to be here, and I'll do my best to try to stay in the right location so it's not too unpleasant. So I really appreciate the invitation from Jacques to speak to you about this topic. Nanotechnology is often, presented as something that is revolutionary and brand new and transformative and going to lead to all kinds of wonderful things. And that's true, but there's also another side of the story which is more of an evolutionary one. That really all fields of science and technology have just kind of converged on this particular length scale. And some people a few years ago had the vision to point out that we're all moving towards the same place, we're all working on similar problems, and it has really encouraged a much more multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary view of this. So what I'd like to do is to tell you the story about nanoelectronics, but to do it in an evolutionary way, because it really is a story of evolution. Okay, so I'll be talking briefly about electronic devices, about microelectronics. So microelectronics is a term you may have heard for many, many years. It was an important technology, but it has evolved into nanoelectronics. And now the big questions that people are asking is, how much longer can we continue to do this? And what's next? And what's next might be some things that are truly fundamentally different. And that's what's one of the things that's exciting about nanoelectronics. So this is a summary of the talk. One of the things I wanted to point out that the modern world that we now take for granted was really shaped by technologies for computing and communication. We don't even think about this now. Underneath it all, electronic devices is what have made all of this possible. And the 20th century was really transformed by electronic and microelectronic technology. And the 21st century is going to be, what's going to happen in the 21st century is we're probably going to look back and it will have been just as profound as what's happened in the 20th century. So by the way, I should encourage you, if there are questions, stop me, we can take questions at the end, but I'd be happy to take questions at any time. Okay, now, since you've had several talks, you may be familiar with some of the scale of things, but just to calibrate ourselves on what a nanometer is, I'm about 6 feet tall, so that's about 2 meters. 1 meter is 1 billion nanometers, so I'm 2 billion nanometers tall. Now, we sort of have a sense as to what a millimeter is, a tiny, grain of sand, ant. We have a good feeling for what a millimeter is. That's 1 million nanometers. Okay. Now when we start getting down to things that are a little too small to see, like the cells in our bodies, then we're in the micrometer regime. And when we go smaller than that, when we go 1,000 times smaller than that, we're in the nanometer regime. And this is the regime, the scale of large biomolecules. The radius of a DNA double helix is about 2 nanometers. So once you get down to this scale, you're down at the scale of molecules, biological entities, where the properties of matter are shaped and determined. Now, we think of nanotechnology as being really small, and it is really small, but it's not too small. You could go below this to the atomic scale. And you could go below that to the subatomic scale, like the physicists at CERN are trying to explore. So a nanometer is very, very small, but this is the shape, this is the length scale where the properties of matter are determined. And that's what makes it so exciting, is that we're getting the ability to begin to shape matter and to engineer materials at this scale. So one of the exciting things is, if you have things that are nanometers in dimension, you can put billions of them in a very small place, and you can make some very complex things. So we also need to think about, you know, how big is a billion things? So, you know, a pop quiz. What year was it a billion seconds ago? 1960. Boy, have you seen this before? You're close. You know, a billion seconds ago, it was 1959. A billion minutes ago, Julius Caesar was around. That was about AD 100 or so. BC 100, I think. A billion hours ago, our ancestors were living in the Stone Age. A billion days ago, nothing was walking on 2 feet on the Earth. And it was a billion years ago that multicellular life first emerged. So I'm going to be talking both about nanometers, things that are a billionth of a meter small, and I'm going to be talking about electronic systems that have billions of components. The two sort of go together. So what I wanted to do is to tell you this evolutionary story of electronic devices. So some of the key dates. First electronic device was a vacuum tube that enabled radio communication, and that was done over 100 years ago. The second key date was about the middle of the 20th century. That was the invention of the transistors, and then computing and communications really took off. 1959, the integrated circuit was invented. We'll talk about that. And that was another giant step forward. Both the transistor and the integrated circuit received Nobel Prizes. 1962, the semiconductor laser was created. So you might know that all internet communication these days, the signals are sent as light pulses, not as electronic pulses, at least long distances, high speed. And they're all sent with lasers, so that enabled communication. So the first devices were vacuum tubes. These were big. And it all started with Edison. When Edison was working on the light bulb, he noticed that the inside of the bulb would become dark. Something was coming off of the filament, and he wasn't quite sure what it was. And the physicist J.J. Thompson in 1897 explained that what was coming off were electrons boiling off of the filament, those cathode rays, and I think he received the Nobel Prize for that. Not long after that, a fellow named Fleming in England made it into an electronic device. So he made it into a diode. He made it into a device that would let current flow in one direction but not in the other. And that was very useful for detecting radio waves and things like that. And then an American named Lee DeForest made it into a really useful device called a triode. And it looks something like this. So it looks like a little light bulb. If you look in the middle of it, there's a filament just like a light bulb. You run power through it, it gets hot, the electrons boil out, off. There is a plate called an anode. It is around the top. And it has a positive voltage, so it attracts the electrons and the current flows out of that. But then Lee DeForest put a little grid, like a piece of screen, in between the cathode and the anode, and he could put a voltage on that and controlled how many electrons could make it to the anode and flow out. And that made a device where you could control the current with a third terminal, and you could, it led to all kinds of things. Like, that was the golden age of radio. Now you could build radio sets that had amplifiers in and high quality sound, and it really had a big impact on life. So people started thinking then beyond radio communication. Electronic computers were formed around World War II when there was a need for a lot of computation to be done. People started working on electronic computers. So this is the first electronic computer called the ENIAC. It was made with vacuum tubes. It had 17,468 vacuum tubes. So you can imagine the room got pretty hot because it's like having 18,000 light bulbs in a room. It had to be cooled. It took quite a bit of floor space. 1,000 square feet. That would be what, a little bit smaller than this room, I suppose. Weighed 30 tons, consumed 150 kilowatts of power, and 50 of those tubes burned out every day. So there was someone whose job was just to go around and replace one every time it burned out. So this was a big problem. Vacuum tubes, you know, light bulbs burn out. Vacuum tubes weren't very reliable. Everyone knew that it would be really useful if we could find a better electronic device to do the same thing, but that didn't burn out so frequently. And it didn't consume so much power. And it was actually, relatively easy for physicists to think about how you would do that. So this is a patent from 1925 in which the concept for the modern transistor was first patented. It was a logical thing to do, and we'll talk about this a little later. But there are three terminals on here, there are two terminals on the top through which current flows, and there's another terminal on the bottom that controls the flow of current. So it's just like a vacuum tube, but instead of a grid or a screen in there that controls current flow, it's this gate on the bottom that does. And he patented it in 25, and a German came up with similar ideas and was working on it. I used to tell this story, maybe it was 20 years ago when I was teaching a junior level class on electronic devices, and I used to tell the story about how people had this idea a long time ago, but no one could make it work, and it took a long time before they figured it out, and the people at Bell Labs got a Nobel Prize. And then at the end of the class, a student came up and he said, "What do you mean they didn't work?" And I said, "Well, that was my understanding. I never, people used vacuum tubes for everything. This was a good idea, but you just couldn't solve the technological problems." And this fellow, he was from somewhere in California, I forget where, and he said, "My next door neighbor is an old German fellow. His name is Heil. And he tells me they work just fine." But apparently they didn't work fine enough. I mean, they were not the dominant electronic technology. So Bell Labs formed a team. This is one of the great successes in, directed goal-driven research. They formed a team and they said, "We must have a better electronic device." They hired a group of very bright people and they put them to work for probably 10 to 15 years to see. And they set out to build this device. Turned out that they couldn't build it. There were some fundamental problems. They learned a lot of interesting physics. They learned why it was so difficult to build. And in the process of doing that, they discovered an effect that led to a different way to make a transistor. And this is what it looks like. If you look at this, you wouldn't predict what this led to. This led to everything we take for granted. You can see something that looks like a paper clip here. It's kind of bent to put a little tension on it to make a good contact. You can see two wires that come down. This is a piece of glass, I think. On one side is a metal electrode, and on the other side is a different metal electrode. So there are three electrodes, one, two, and the bottom is a third one. It's sitting on a piece of germanium, which is a good material for making transistors out of. When Bell Labs started this work, they had to pick semiconductors, and there were two choices, silicon or germanium. The reason they picked germanium is because there was a very big and very famous effort here at Purdue in the physics department on germanium. There was a lot of work done. There was a lot of techniques to grow high-quality germanium and to understand it. So it was the best understood semiconductor. And the Bell Labs people picked germanium because of that Purdue work. Okay, so it's hard to predict from something this crude where it led to, but many people think that this was the most important invention of the 20th century because of what it led to. Some people will argue and say, no, it was the integrated circuit, but they're closely related, and we'll see. So it led to the transistor. I don't know if I should. No. So here's what one is, Whoops. Hopefully they're not too fragile. I mean, they have three leads on them. Current flows through two of them. The third one controls the flow of current. They're cheap these days. You don't have to worry about dropping it. It doesn't matter. But, they're tiny little, they were tiny compared to vacuum tubes. They use minuscule amounts of power compared to vacuum tubes. But they weren't really a replacement. They weren't as high quality a device. They couldn't replace vacuum tubes in most applications. So people started to think, well, this is something new. It's different. You know, what could it be useful for? One of the things they started making were hearing aids, because there you need some very small electronics to amplify signals. You don't want to stick vacuum tubes in your ears. Right? Another thing that they thought about were radios. So this is a transistor radio in 1954. It's a fairly early one. You can see that it's pretty small, not as small as they are today. It was built by a company called Regency. Does anybody know where Regency was located? Indianapolis. So it was the first example I know of where transistors were really put to use in a commercial market. But they didn't quite hit it big. Another company really hit it big with transistors, and that was a Japanese company, Sony. Yeah. And they produced a 6-transistor shirt pocket radio. And this, there was a market for this. Now you could carry your radio around, listen to it. I remember this as a kid. It wasn't quite a shirt pocket. He couldn't quite get it to fit in a shirt pocket, so he made special shirts for his salesmen that had a pocket that was just a little bit bigger. And then when they went, they could sell their shirt pocket radios. And that really produced a market that set transistors off, generated revenue. People plowed that revenue back into R&D and then developed more and more technology. That was very important. Okay. All right. So I'm not going to get much into the details. This is the way when we're making electronic circuits, we draw symbols for transistors. This isn't the physical structure, but you can see there are 3 terminals labeled source, drain, gate. And there are really 2 purposes for this device. One is that it operates as a switch. The 3rd terminal either opens or closes the switch, and it's either on or off. The 2nd way is it operates as an amplifier, like in that shirt pocket radio. So you feed a small signal in that is getting louder and softer with time, and you amplify it, and a big signal comes out. So the first application we call digital electronics. We build computers out of transistors when we just operate them as switches. If it's on, it's a 1. If it's off, it's a 0. And analog electronics, when we build amplifiers and sound systems and things like that. Okay. Now, the next big step in this story was the invention of the integrated circuit. And this is credited to 2 people, and there are actually several people that were working on it, Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments and Bob Noyce at Fairchild Semiconductor. And, the way the story goes is Jack Kilby, I think, had just graduated from the University of Illinois. He was a new engineer. He was working at Texas Instruments, and I think it was Thanksgiving vacation. And there was something like you didn't get any vacation for the first year. I think everybody else was off, but he had to work. And the whole place was quiet. There was really nothing to disturb him. He had to do something, so he just thought, and this idea occurred to him. Instead of taking these small little transistors, putting them all together, soldering all the leads together, why don't I just build many transistors on 1 chunk of material and wire them all up while I'm building them? That's called an integrated circuit. Everything is built monolithically on 1 chunk of material. You don't build the individual pieces and then try to assemble them. You just build them onto 1 piece of material. And that was the next big step. Eventually, it got a Nobel Prize. So an integrated circuit is just a collection of transistors. And it wasn't very long, 1971, before Intel made a little computer chip called the 4004. And it had 2,200 transistors. Remember, that first big computer had 18,000 vacuum tubes. So this one wasn't quite as ambitious, but it could run faster and consume less power. It actually did as much computation as that room-sized vacuum tube computer, but it did it at a fraction of the cost, and it lasted for years. Things didn't burn out. So it was a big step forward. There wouldn't be personal computers without that. And let me just very quickly explain, how do you make a digital computer? Well, you hook up some basic building blocks, and one is called an inverter, and it has two different flavors of transistors. If you apply a large voltage on the input, it'll flip the switch and turn the N-channel device on and turn the P-channel device off. If you put a low voltage in, it'll turn the P-channel device on and the N-channel device off. Those are called complementary. This is the mainstream technology these days, complementary metal oxide semiconductor technology. So if you put a low voltage in, it flips the switch and turns the P-channel device on, and it connects the output to the high voltage power supply. If you put a high voltage in, it opens the switch on the top and closes the switch on the bottom and connects you to zero voltage. So it takes a digital logic one, converts it to a zero, and vice versa. It inverts a signal. Okay. So that's just a transfer characteristic of it. And you can do digital computation, and the way people do digital computation is with gates like this. So an AND gate is a circuit that if you have two inputs and one output, it will only produce a one output if both inputs are one. So you draw a truth table like this. Unless, you know, the first input can be zero, the second input can be zero, the output will be zero. It takes two input ones to make an output one. And you can wire up transistors, and if you just think about it as flipping the N channel on with a one, the P channel off with a one, the P channel on with a zero, the N channel off, you could trace through this and you could see that it almost does this logic gate, except that it does exactly the opposite. If you put two ones in, you get a zero out. Otherwise, you get a one. But that's okay, because now you can put it through an inverter and you can get an AND gate. So with gates like this, you can build any, this is how engineers design digital computers. It's just thousands of gates like this hooked up in the right way. So that's what's enabled it all. And I brought some show and tell here, and see if I can see it without setting things off. So integrated circuits are built on a silicon wafer. And let me show you a silicon wafer. All right. This is a silicon wafer. These days, they're about 12 inches in diameter. This is a high-quality, single-crystal piece of silicon. It's probably the purest material known to humankind, refined better than any other material. On each of those wafers are many chips. Each chip is a complete circuit containing thousands, or these days, billions of transistors. If you look at one of those chips, you will see that it consists of things like, this is a microprocessor unit. That's a little computer. There's some logic gates, AND and OR gates and inverters to control everything. This is a cell phone chip. There's some analog circuitry to do some amplification of the signal and things when you're speaking into the cell phone. There's some read-only memory and some random access memory to store things while everything is operating. And there's a digital signal processing component that processes some of the speech and makes it intelligible and codes things. And the size of each of these chips is something like 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters. So a big chip these days is a little less than an inch by an inch. And then you put it on a big wafer like this. And I won't pass this one around because I don't want to set that off. And this is also the only one I have. It took me, it was actually a little hard to get that. So let me go very quickly through how these are made, because I want to talk about some of the challenges in the evolution of this technology and, you know, where nanoelectronics comes in. Okay. So, you know, this is a quick story about how it's made. First of all, you need a plan, and you might imagine that if you're going to wire up a billion transistors to do some function, it's a pretty complicated plan. In fact, some people have said that is the thing that might stop the evolution of this technology, is that these systems are getting so complicated to design, even with the help of computers, that it takes teams of, you know, one engineer designed the first microprocessor, now it takes probably 200 to design a state-of-the-art microprocessor, and pretty soon it might take 1,000, and it's just getting so complicated that it's hard to coordinate all of that. All right, then you make some masks. These are the patterns that if you were close enough, you could see that make the transistors. We'll talk about what those are about. Then you need a crystalline silicon. Actually, this is done by some other factory somewhere, but this is really a cylinder of silicon, single crystal piece of silicon that might be 15 feet tall, 12 inches in diameter, grown very carefully. It's called a boule. Then you saw it up into individual wafers. They're each thin, but not too thin, so that they don't break. And you polish each wafer so that it has a smooth surface. Then you expose that to oxygen, and it creates a thin layer of silicon dioxide, which is just quartz, very high-quality glass that protects the surface. Okay. Now, the next step, you know, you all remember photographic film, but when I'm telling this to students, I find most of them don't remember photographic film. But the next step is like photographic film. You put a material on that's like an emulsion, and it's sensitive to light. Now you take that mask that has the patterns that define the circuit, and you expose it to light. And, you know, where the pattern is opaque, it isn't exposed, other places it's exposed. So it creates an image, just like an image used to be created on a piece of photographic film, not a digital camera. Now you have an image. So now some of that resist material is there, and some places are open. Then you expose it to a chemical that will attack the quartz layer underneath it. Now you've exposed some of the bare silicon. Now you have little pieces where the silicon is exposed. Okay. Now we can modify the properties of the silicon. We can put a little phosphorus in it, sometimes a little arsenic, a little boron, and it changes the properties of the silicon in specific locations, changes it in a way that we can make the various terminals of the transistor. Okay, after we've done that, so that's the yellow layers now, you have to wire everything up. So then we just take this wafer and we evaporate aluminum over the entire wafer, or copper these days. So now we've got a continuous film of copper. Everything is wired, everything is shorted together. But we have to connect some transistors to specific other transistors. So now we put a layer of the resist or photographic emulsion on it again. We have another pattern that has the pattern for how we want to wire everything up. We expose that material. We develop it, now we have a pattern, and then we go to a different etch that removes the copper wherever it's exposed, and that leaves the metal where it's supposed to be. And now we've got the whole thing wired up. And these days, you might expect that it takes a lot of wire to wire up a billion transistors and connect everyone to the ones it needs to be connected to. So people do layers on layers of metal, so that you can run them different directions and stack them on top of each other and they're not connected together. All right, then you test everything. So not every one of these will work. There'll be a speck of dust on some of them that will kill it and it won't be functional. So when you're done, you go through and you test them to see which ones are good and which ones aren't. The yields these days are really high. Then you saw them all up into individual chips. Jacques, could you get me that? I don't dare go over there. No, the little one behind, yes, that one. So if we saw these up and sort them out, the good ones from the bad ones, then we'll take the good ones and we'll mount them in a package. So here's a little square chip we can pass this one around to. You can see there are hundreds of pins that these get the signals and the power and everything we need into the chip. So that's what it looks like after we package it up. We can pass that one around to see what a chip looks like. And then we're all done. So here is, things move so fast. This is called 65 nanometer technology. So this is the dimension of these patterns that we're producing on the chip in order to make these circuits. So we're well within this nanometer regime these days. The technology was first called microelectronics, because the patterns had sizes of microns. Now we measure the patterns in terms of nanometers, and we call it nanoelectronics. So there are over a billion transistors on this chip. There are two logic cores. There are two little computers on this particular chip, and there's 120 million transistors in each of those. It runs very high speed, takes about a volt to power it all up. It dissipates actually quite a lot of power. 150 watts for one of these little chips is a lot, because there are a lot of things dissipating power there. The amazing thing, if you look at all of the wire, you know, you go layer upon layer of wire to wire up these billion transistors, there's 6,000 meters. So what's that? I should have done this ahead of time. How many miles is that? 3 miles or so, roughly? What is it? About 1,000 yards in a mile? Yeah, roughly. And this is roughly a yard.
Excuse me. 1,000 meters is a mile, I mean kilometer.
Pardon me?
1,000 meters is a kilometer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because kilometer, you change from meter to mile, that is,
so this is
650 meters. Right?
Yeah. Okay. So this is like 6 kilometers. And that's what, 4 miles or so? All right. Good. So someone can do math better. That's a lot of wire. You know, that's how much it takes to wire up one of these little chips. And in fact, if you do a cross section, we've just been looking down at the top of these chips. If you do a cross section and look at it on the side, way down here on the bottom, you see the silicon wafer. If you look really carefully, you can see the transistors. The three terminals, the source, the gate, and the drain. But then what you see is layer upon layer upon layer of metal that's wiring everything up. Okay. So, is Moore's Law a term that people are familiar with? Okay. Well, this is Gordon Moore. He's one of the co-founders of Intel. And, in about 1965, he started making these graphs. They were making crude integrated circuits, and every year they would be able to put a few more transistors on a chip. And he just noted empirically that every year, the number of transistors that they were able to put on a chip doubled. And he drew this dashed line, and he said, this will probably continue for a few more years. No science behind it, just an observation. And it turns out, that was done in 1965. It has almost done that. It now doubles about every 18 months. But every 18 months, you put twice as many transistors on a chip. That means the electronic system that you can manufacture is twice as powerful. It can do twice as much. This is called Moore's Law. And it's not really a law, it's just an observation. But it's something that people have worked so hard to make sure that it continues. And I don't think Gordon Moore or anybody else expected that it would last as long as it has. And it's the big question these days is, how much longer can it last? So now you plot this on a log plot. So this is the number of transistors per chip starting from 1970. This is 5 years after Moore first said it's been doubling every technology generation. And that has more or less happened and continues to happen. And the question now on everybody's mind is, how much longer can we do this? Okay. Yes. Yes.
Is this how our cell phones work?
Cell phones?
Yep. You know, the phones we carry with us, is this how?
You bet. So none of these things that we take for granted would be possible unless we had these really sophisticated electronic systems. And they're all made possible because we can put so many components on a single little chip. And, you know, if you remember a few years ago when there were portable phones, there were these big bulky things you carried around. But by making them smaller and smaller, we can do the same thing. It's the same reason that that room-sized computer was replaced by this tiny little chip. So that's why I say it is really, you know, the things that we just take for granted today are all enabled by this technology. So this is your question. You know, everything, all of these devices, satellite communications, supercomputers, personal computers, you know, cell phones, everything that we just take for granted, inside it has a silicon chip like this. And it's a really important part of the industry, you know. So it's the entire industry is about $260 billion a year globally. It's dominated by the U.S., South Korea, Japan, and Europe. It's actually the second largest export for the U.S. But, you know, the chip that goes inside a cell phone, so the cell phone gets sold for a lot more than the chip did. the personal computer gets, you know, a lot more revenue is generated by the products that are enabled by this technology inside them. So there's really a $1.2 trillion world market in cell phones and personal computers and everything that wouldn't be possible without these chips inside them. And the services, you know, people that do IT services and accounting services and all of these things that are enabled by computers, that's a $5 trillion a year service. And overall, it's about 10% of the GDP of the entire world. So it's a really important technology, and these questions about how much longer can we continue to evolve this are very important questions to people. Now, you know, one of the things, when you plot this, it's hard to appreciate what's really going on when you plot it on these log plots. So this is the same plot of Moore's law, but I just do it on a linear scale, going from zero transistors on a chip to 2 billion. And this is Intel data. If you look at this, it looked like nothing even happened until 2000. And then things took off. I mean, actually, there was a lot happening there, and we thought it was really sophisticated technology, but you can't see it on this plot. And this is why it's so important, because every 18 months, you double what it's taking you the previous 40 years to do. And then in another 18 months, you double it again. And then in another 18 months, you double it again. So if you could just carry that on a few more times, you know, the kinds of things you can build are just, you know, revolutionary. And it's all done by what people call device scaling. You make each transistor smaller, then you can put more of them on a chip. So this is this is what a physical picture of a transistor looks like. This is the silicon wafer that it sits on. We've chemically altered two little parts, one called the source and one called the drain. That's where the current wants to flow. And then we put a third electrode between them. And that either closes the switch or opens it. And there's a thin insulating layer in between there. And what we do, you know, it sounds simple, but you take this length scale and you reduce it by a factor of the square root of 2 every 18 months. And then the area is length squared, so that reduces the area of each transistor by a factor of 2. Then you can put twice as many in the same area, and then Moore's law continues for another 18 months. So that's what people have been doing for the last 40 years, working really hard every 18 months to shrink the dimensions by a square root of 2. So we've gotten to the point where this is 1 year old now. This is a 45 nanometer technology. The actual channel length is about 30 nanometers. So they've gotten really small. This thin insulating layer that separates the control electrode from the other two, that's only 1.1 nanometers thick. So that's half the radius of a DNA double helix. And, you know, you can look at that with atomic resolution. You can count, you can see each individual atom. There are only about 3 atomic layers of that insulating layer. And if there's a pinhole anywhere, the chip is dead. It doesn't function. And those things are controlled with atomic precision across this 12-inch wafer. And then these things are cranked out by the thousands every day. And it's just, I had a colleague at Intel who gave me a tour through their fab a couple of years ago, and he showed me all this. And he said, you know, Mark, if I stop and think about this, I just can't believe any of it works. You know, it's... But it does. So the official definition of nanotechnology is working in this length scale of the 1 to 100 nanometer regime. You know, not in the atomic regime, which is smaller than a nanometer, but in this regime where you can really shape the properties of matter. And by doing things that are not just smaller, but are fundamentally different. So as you saw from that plot, you know, electronic technology has just evolved step by step every 18 months to this nanoscale regime. And some of the challenges for continuing this, you know, it sounds easy. Just shrink everything by a factor of square root of 2. It's enormously difficult. You know, these patterns that you expose, you might guess that you couldn't make a pattern that's smaller than the wavelength of light that's exposing it. But look at this. The light that's used these days is 193 nanometers. That's its wavelength. The patterns it produces are 32 nanometers. You know, it's just amazing that people have figured out how to do this. They have very sophisticated masks. They have optical waves that interfere with others. They produce a pattern on the wafer that's not the pattern that they want. But after the light diffracts and does everything, they end up with a pattern that they want. And they can do all of this magic. One of the big challenges, you can see how close all of these terminals, to shrink it, everything gets closer together. It gets very hard to shut this transistor off. You want it to be a switch that's on or off. But when these electrodes are so close, the current wants to flow all the time. It's very hard to shut it off. That's a big challenge. You want a lot of current to flow when it's on, and you want that to happen at low voltage, and that's a challenge. I'll explain why you want it to happen at low voltage in a minute. But there are other challenges too. One of the challenges is in variability. The devices are so small that if you can begin to, as I said, you produce a device by introducing some extra phosphorus or extra arsenic or something into small regions of the silicon, the regions are so small now that you can count the number that you've introduced. And you might have 101 transistor, and you might have 93 in the next transistor, and they'll have slightly different properties. So they're so small that just the presence, the fact that there's a fluctuation in the number of atoms that you've introduced into one versus the other will change their properties. And that makes it very hard for designers, because they have a billion transistors and you're trying to design a circuit with them, and everyone has different properties. And I mentioned design complexity. You know, the systems themselves are so complex that that's a problem too. So this was a famous slide that Intel produced several years ago. You get more and more transistors on a chip, and when you operate them, they consume power. Remember, the original reason for going to transistors is because these vacuum tubes consumed so much power. Now we've gotten to a point where we put so many transistors on a chip that even though each one consumes a minuscule amount of power compared to a vacuum tube, when you have over a billion, it all adds up. And when they dissipate power, just like a light bulb, they get hot. And you put a billion of them on a chip, your laptop gets warm, right? And what the engineers at Intel noticed, that if you just plot this versus year, you can see that every year you dissipate a little more power because you're putting more transistors on. So back in the mid-90s, we got to 10 watts per square centimeter. That's actually pretty hot. That's like a hot plate. And you could just project out what was going to happen if nothing changed. And the projection was that, well, the power densities would be comparable to a nuclear reactor by 2005. They would be comparable to a rocket nozzle before 2010. And just a few more years, they would be equal to the power density on the surface of the sun. All right, so obviously that's not going to happen. And this has been a big challenge for designers, that you can't just put more transistors on a chip. It'll melt. Right? You have to figure out ways to only turn them on when you need them. And that makes life more complicated. Okay, but the reason it's so important is because of this exponential growth. As long as there's no fundamental physics that says you can't do this, companies are going to invest as much as they can to take that next step. You know, keep Moore's Law going. And each technology generation, the main technology these days is called 45 nanometer technology. I first did this little table when the main technology was 90 nanometers. Intel just introduced 32 nanometer technology. And this is the big question on people's minds. How long can you do this? How many transistors can you put on a chip? And what can you do with them? So here's where I get to the last part of the talk. How much longer do we have, Jacques?
30 minutes.
It's not going to take 30 minutes, so I hope you have some questions. Okay. So people are working very hard just to continue Moore's Law. Shrink transistors every 18 months. General feeling is that we can do that for maybe another 10 years. Well, then, of course, for the last 30 years, we've said it looks like we can do this for another 10 years, and then it will be impossible. But there is a limit somewhere. So people are looking at what can we do beyond Moore's Law. This is the big phrase you use in research programs. people look for beyond Moore's Law research. So when you can no longer make a silicon transistor smaller, then what do you do? So there are lots of ideas. You know, we're having lots of fun, and other people are too. Companies are very serious about it. They're funding a lot of research here at Purdue and at other universities. So this is one idea, and actually there was some pioneering work done by my colleagues here at Purdue in the Ciprio Dada in electrical engineering and Ron Reifenberger in physics, who succeeded in attaching metal electrodes to small molecules that were just like 10 nanometers or so across. I think this is phenyl diethyl, small organic molecule. And if the small molecule, you know, then instead of having to manufacture this very small pattern, take a big chunk of silicon and then etch away material and make something very small, you could take molecules that have a naturally small size and assemble them between two contacts, and now you would have a very small transistor. And if you could figure out a way to squeeze a third terminal in close, you could make a transistor. You could control the current flow through the two leads by the potential on the third one. And there's been a lot of work addressed at that. There has been some success, but it doesn't address the fundamental challenge that people have today. If you were to put all of these transistors on a chip, the power density would be so high that it would melt immediately. So it's more than just making things smaller. We have to figure out how to make them consume less power at the same time. There's also a lot of work in things called carbon nanotubes. So graphene is a single sheet of carbon atoms. It's sort of arranged in a hexagon, you know, like a wire mesh, where each of the carbon atoms is arranged in a hexagonal structure and it's one monolayer thick. When you write with a pencil lead, what's coming off are sheets of graphene. You know, each sheet is not bonded strongly to the other, so it comes off easily. But people, electronics people and physicists have learned how to take these individual sheets and put them on a surface and then pattern them and make electronic devices. What they also learned how to do was to take these sheets and roll them up into little tubes. Now, these are called carbon nanotubes. And if you roll them up, you just take the sheet and you roll it up, and now you have a small tube with a diameter of about 1 nanometer, about half the diameter of a DNA double helix. And if you roll them in one way, they're semiconductors, like silicon, and you can make transistors out of them. And if you roll them in a different direction, they're metals, and you can use them to connect up transistors. And they have wonderful electronic properties, and people were very excited about them. We collaborated with Hongji Dai, a chemist at Stanford, and we did quite a bit of collaboration with him for a while in demonstrating these kinds of carbon nanotube transistors. So here's a carbon nanotube, here's the two contacts, here's the third contact that controls the current. This is looking down at the top. Probably none of you can see this, but there's the gate metal coming right here, and there's a very thin line through the middle. That's that carbon nanotube that's 1 nanometer in diameter. Okay. So there are lots of new ways to build electronic devices based on all of these new ideas coming out of nanoelectronics. Some of them have to do with building transistors and keeping Moore's Law going. That's a big concern of people. But others do completely different things, and I'll just mention this just a little bit. You know, one of the things that people do is just try to disperse these over large areas. They have very good electronic properties. So this is an example of where you're taking things that are nanoscale and you're trying to engineer the properties of a macroscale material by controlling the properties of each of these individual nanotubes. And you can do things like make flexible electronics or large area displays, very high performance. I'll talk a bit. You can make exquisitely sensitive sensors. I'll talk a little bit about that. Some of these other applications. So there's lots of different electronic device ideas that people are exploring that might open up many different applications that don't have to do with digital computing and Moore's Law. And that's part of what's exciting about this. So one of the exciting things is that the size of these electronic devices has gotten comparable to the size of DNA and other biological molecules. So there's a lot of interest in the merger of electronics and biology, using electronics for personalized medicine and things. Because if you just look at the dimensions, you know, they're all similar dimensions now. So we're working at the same length scale. So one of the things that people are thinking about is, if I could make a tiny little pore in this silicon, if I could etch a tiny little pore, a little hole in the silicon, put some metal electrodes around, and drive a strand of DNA through that little hole, then all of the base pairs have some charge. Each time that charge goes by one of these metal electrodes, it registers a signal, and you might be able to electronically sequence DNA, and that could be a very low-cost way to do a genome sequencing, and could open up opportunities in things like personalized medicine and just make it very much less expensive and easy to do. These are some nano cantilevers that were done by Rashid Bashir and Ashraf Alam. This is a thin beam of silicon that's etched out of silicon. And if you attach a single molecule to the end of it, it'll bend. And optically, you can detect that bending by a reflection, and you can weigh a single atom. So what people do is they put certain receptors on that beam, which will bind with a particular, maybe cancer marker or something that you're trying to detect. And when it binds, then the beam gets heavier, it deflects. Depending on how many of them bind, you can tell what the concentration is, and you can build an exquisite sensor. I mentioned nanowire sensors. For a long time, people realized that you could take transistors and you could make them into chemical sensors. If you just remove the third terminal, and then if you let some target species bind to the region between the gate and between the source and the drain, then instead of applying a voltage to turn the current on and off, the charge on those molecules will make the current bigger or smaller, and you can detect then the presence of these molecules. Now, this had some particular sensitivity. It would do millimolar or micromolar sensitivity, which is reasonably sensitive. But what's happened recently is that people have been able to learn how to make nanowires. So small wires like carbon nanotubes that have a diameter of only a few nanometers but are long. Now, if a single species binds to that, it has a very big effect, because the structure is so small that if one target molecule binds to it, you get a big change in the signal. And people were able to go from micrometer, this should be a micron, micrometer molar sensitivity, to picometer or even femtomolar. Let's see, this is a factor micromolar, nanomolar is a factor of 1,000, picomolar is a factor of 1,000,000, femtomolar is a factor of 1,000,000,000. So nanoelectronics made it possible to make sensors like this that were 1,000,000,000 times more sensitive than the previous technology, than the micro technology. So now you can do things like doing electronic analysis of, you know, blood samples and things that could be cheap, easy to do, and, you know, maybe with disposable chips. So there's lots of interest in medicine that way. Now, one of the big things that people are talking about, you know, nanotechnology in principle gives you this ability to shape matter the way you would and give it the properties that would be desirable for a certain application. And one of the big issues on everybody's mind these days is energy. And of course, solar energy is one. The modern solar cell was also invented back there in the early days when Bell Labs was inventing the transistor and things. Someone else at Bell Labs demonstrated the modern silicon solar cell in 1954. So it's been around a long time. Cost is still an issue, but the market is growing. The efficiency of these early cells was about 4 or 5%. The efficiencies today are more like 15 to 20%, 25% in the laboratory. But, you know, this high-quality silicon is pretty expensive. So the challenge is to bring the cost down so that you could have a larger market. And one of the ideas, so this is where we're working more and more with chemists, and this is one of the things that nanotechnology has done for us, is it's brought people in different disciplines much more closely together. So we're having a lot of fun working with chemists on a topic called organic solar cells. So these are simple organic polymers, and they can phase segregate into two different regions. one which is called a donor region, which donates an electron to the other region. The other region is called an acceptor region. And if we attach an electrode on the bottom and an electrode on the top, and we shine light on this system, if the top electrode is transparent, we can generate current and collect it and run it out through the electrodes. Now, the attraction of this is that the efficiencies aren't going to be nearly as high as high-quality crystalline silicon, but it might be much, much cheaper. And it's requiring us to understand if you produce these materials, you distribute these over a large area, you anneal it for a while, and it segregates into the donor region and the acceptor region. The longer you anneal it, the bigger these regions get. There is some optimum for the performance, and we're trying to learn how you think about what that optimum is. So there's a lot of interest in this as a really low-cost way. And you could think about things like spray coating this on your roof, you know, very inexpensively. And I'll just mention, you know, I guess I'm mentioning a few examples of why people in the electronic device field find this field so interesting. There are lots of different devices that do lots of different things. So one is called a thermoelectric device. So this is a device, you know, something like a transistor made from semiconductors. And what it does one of two things. It either converts heat into electricity, solar cell converts light into electricity, or if you run electricity through it, one side gets hot and the other side gets cold. So you could think about either taking waste heat from a manufacturing plant or the waste heat from the automobile engine of your car and converting it into electricity. People are working on that. You could think about replacing your refrigerator and the mechanical compressor and all of that with just a simple little chip, you know, solid material, no moving parts that would cool. So that's been a hope that people have had for a long time. In fact, they've had it about 1950 is when people first realized that these devices could be built, done by a Russian scientist. And there's a particular figure of merit that controls how well these devices, how efficiently these devices work. And it quickly went up to about one. It's a dimensionless number. The higher it is, the more efficient the technology is. And it got one. There doesn't seem to be any fundamental reason that it couldn't be higher than one. So people have been working since 1950 to try to get it higher. If it could be three, you know, the results would just be transformative. You could convert vast amounts of waste heat into electricity. You could replace all mechanical refrigeration with electronic refrigeration. And a lot of PhD thesis research has been done on this over the years. It's just people have been looking for any possible way to try to get the figure of merit above one. My PhD thesis advisor did this when he was a graduate student. But recently, people have started to have some success. They're starting to engineer the properties of these materials on the nanoscale. So instead of hunting for materials that nature gives us and seeing if you can find one that has a figure of merit greater than one, you try to engineer materials to have the properties that you need to get a figure of merit greater than one. And, you know, what these techniques have in common is that they all make use of nanostructuring in one way or another. Okay, so, you know, I think I'm about ready to end, and if there are some questions, I'd be happy to take them. Now, I mainly wanted to leave you with a few thoughts. You know, nanoelectronics, just like all of nanotechnology, is about engineering matter on the nanoscale. And then taking these very small building blocks and hooking them up so that you can have very complicated systems that include billions or trillions of those building blocks. And really, the evolution of science and technology has taken almost every field down to this scale. Just the natural course, catalysis is a nanotechnology. Chemists have worked there for a long time. Mechanical engineers or engineering properties of heat flow. We're all working in this domain. So it is, in order to realize these, it has really spurred a lot of work across disciplines. You know, it's been very positive in terms of what's happened then. Now, if I look at electronics technology, the end of CMOS has been predicted many times. It's still going strong. We all know that it will saturate sometime. But, you know, it seems likely that it's going to continue to evolve for another 10 years. I think it will go more than 10 years. And this doubling every 18 months will just continue to build up. And in 10 or 15 years, we'll look back and we'll think all of the things that we have now we'll think are really crude because we'll be able to do so much more. But at the same time that that evolves, there are all of these other possibilities for using electronic devices in new ways that address problems in human health and in energy and lots of other activities. So more and more. So people who do research in this field talk about more and more. That means more and Moore's law. And then they talk about more than more. That means doing things that are different than Moore's law. And I think you're going to see a lot of intense focus on both on more and more and more than more. So thank you for listening. If there are questions, I'd be happy to take a few. Thank you.
Is the size and complexity of these units get smaller? Do they get more expensive? So there's an economic limit?
So the question is, does this all get more expensive to do this? And, you know, it does. Sometimes people refer to a second Moore's law, and that's that the cost of the factory doubles every time you do this. Yes, it's not quite true because you reuse a lot of the equipment, but it's getting enormously expensive. Now, on the other hand, that's not stopping anything. Because if you look at the cost per transistor, or if you look at the cost per electronic function, that continues to go down rapidly. So it continues to make sense to do this. Yeah.
You talked rather quickly at the end about the possibility of tailoring chemical compounds. I think that's what you were saying. We know the electronic structure of lots of things, and we know the physical properties of those same things. Mm-hmm. Now you have a scaffold of carbon. Is there work going on building on that scaffold, the way the body builds on things?
Yeah.
For instance, rare earth oxides that we use for making magnets and all sorts of things are rather common in the world, but they're not concentrated as ores.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the cost of extracting those becomes really prohibitive. And I think there's only one place in the United States that still does that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered whether it would be possible to essentially engineer the properties that we need for some of these exotic compounds.
There's a hope and there are people working on that. You know, this idea of scaffolding, sometimes, you know, people look at things like DNA as a way that now you could use that as a scaffold and then try to build on top of that certain electronic functions. And there are various examples where you begin with something that has some nanostructure and then it's not going to be an active device, say, the way I'm building, but you can now attach various chemical components to them and build up. You know, use that as a template to build something more complicated. There is this whole idea that I haven't talked about called self-assembly. You know, that, you know, chemistry and nature build things up without, you know, what electronics does is this top-down. You start with a design, you take a material that already exists, you remove other materials, and you create a pattern. Could you do it the way biology does it, where you start with something small, and you just let everything build up by making use of the natural chemistry that's there and build up a complex structure that you want. People refer to that as programmed materials. You know, you start with something simple, you see the end result of what you want to produce, and you engineer the chemistry and the material scientist science so that it automatically builds the structure that you want. But there's hope. I don't know how close people are to realizing that yet. I'm part of a team that is reviewing the National Nanotechnology Initiative after 10 years and looking at where the areas to emphasize are for the next 10 years. This is one of the key areas that they're going to see as an area that needs to be emphasized in the coming.
In digital photography, some cameras have CMOS sensors. Others have a different kind of sensor based on a different technology, and I can't think right now what it's called.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the two?
So the question is, why do some cameras have CMOS sensors, some have charge-coupled device sensors?
Yeah, CCD, that's it.
Right. Actually, it's interesting. The CCD was just the subject of the last Nobel Prize in physics. CCDs are, they're not standard CMOS technology.
Right.
It's a specially developed device. They're used, I think, for the most demanding applications. A lot of times they're used in astronomy when you want very high sensitivity with small numbers of photons. One of the amazing things about CMOS is used in a lot of applications where it's not the best technology. But it is so cheap, it is so ubiquitous, that if you can find some way to make a CMOS transistor sensitive to light, you'll do it. And so a CMOS, and if you shine light near a CMOS transistor, it'll collect charge and you can make an image. And since you want to then digitally process that image, then you've got the digital electronics right there in the same chip. So from a system perspective, even though it's not the best imaging technology, it's the cheapest and best way to build the system.
Mark, is there work being done on integrating this kind of technology with the science of repairing spines in people, or repairing nervous systems? One of the things that we seem to be concerned about, obviously.
Yeah, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I know there's a lot to this field about the integration of electronics and biology. And in these kind of prosthetics or kinds of applications like that, you're probably going to need a lot of digital signal processing, right? To take the signals that you want to control, process them, and then you have a mechanical structure or something or whatever can be driven by that. So that's probably going to involve chips that'll be implanted into the body. One of the things that people are thinking about is how do you power these chips? If you have to implant batteries and things, that's a little inconvenient. So people are looking at ways. This is one of the applications for this thermoelectric technology. If you've got a small thermal gradient within the body, you can use that thermal gradient to generate some electricity that might power one of these implantable chips. People are even looking at using ATP to power chips.
Okay, Mark, I think that was a splendid presentation. Okay. And I think it was a very nice way at the end of the series to kind of summarize things and show us the beginning and the end and where the limitations are.
Okay.
I think that was really very great. On behalf of Wada, let me give you this little souvenir over here from your efforts of presenting this material to us.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much, John. Okay.